Britain.
Badgett. The Great Divide. Globalisation separates Tony Blair's Labour from the party today.
It is hard to imagine today's shadow cabinet making a visit like that paid to Japan by Sir Tony Blair, then leader of the opposition, in 1996. The delegation giggled as a businessman declared in imperfect English that he was looking forward to their big election, recalled Alistair Campbell, an aide. The future Prime Minister was later seen in his bedroom wearing only a pair of underpants and an earthquake helmet, pretending to speak Japanese. Like a university rugby club, New Labour was brainy but boorish. The party today would also not offer up a speech like that which Sir Tony gave in Japan to the Keidan Ren, a business group. It contained the most important and consistent idea of New Labour, that the task of government was to equip Britons to compete in an age of globalisation. Protectionism was futile, Sir Tony said. The creative age would belong to the open, flexible and smart. That meant embracing foreign investment and the internet. Trade unions could forget about junking Margaret Thatcher's labour laws. Schools and universities were the highest priority. A decade later, he scoffed at those who wanted to press pause. You might as well debate whether autumn should follow summer. It is in their assessment of globalisation that the greatest difference lies between the Labour leadership today and Blairism. The most consistent thread in the writings and speeches of Rachel Reeves, Labour's shadow chancellor, is scepticism about the fruits of globalisation and concern about its costs. She is a proponent of what this newspaper has called homeland economics, a belief in vogue across the rich world that it is necessary and possible to mesh economic policy with notions of national security and greater self-sufficiency. Protectionism pulls well, and economic liberals are in retreat across the political spectrum. But the obituaries for Sir Tony's agenda are nonetheless premature. Ms. Reeves argues that although New Labour oversaw rapid growth, it made serious errors. Sir Tony's government regulated banking too loosely. Ms. Reeves was working in the retail mortgage department of HBOS, a doomed lender, when the financial crisis struck. It became reliant on despots for energy and critical goods. Globalisation spread insecure work and deepened regional inequality. We cannot, as we have done too readily in the past, prize flexibility to the detriment of security, nor fetishise openness at the cost of resilience, she wrote recently. What changed? In part, the world. In 1997, as David Lammy, the shadow foreign secretary, often says, Britain's economy was larger than China's and India's combined. The intellectual climate changed too. New Labour drew inspiration from Bill Clinton's Democrats. The party today looks to Joe Biden's industrial strategy. And electoral politics is also at work. Whereas Sir Tony pursued the aspirational middle class to win, today the party promises a revival of blue-collar jobs because it sees regaining voters in old industrial seats as an existential quest. The Labour Party under Sir Keir Starmer is cautious and institutionalist. The party promises not to tear up trade deals or to pursue a policy of Fortress Britain, and some greater caution is overdue. The moniker Londongrad gained currency under New Labour as the government enabled an influx of wealthy Russians into the capital. Today, Mr. Lammy and others promise to make Britain a hostile environment for kleptocrats by targeting the British lawyers and accountants who help them. But there is also a real risk of overcorrection. The party has promised to overhaul the public interest tests on takeovers to support sovereign capabilities. It wants to tinker with procurement rules to nudge more government contracts to British firms. It will look more sceptically at Chinese-made electric vehicles, now subject to American and EU tariffs. Ms. Reeves observed recently that they enjoy an extraordinary degree of subsidy and that reliance on them would leave Britain exposed. Labour plans a state-owned energy firm to pursue self-sufficiency, not just in terms of where electricity is generated, but also which firms are involved and where kit is made. Sir Tony's think tank, by contrast, advocates putting public money into climate R&D. These represent real and substantial differences from the Blairite view of the world. But what has not changed is that Britain is highly exposed to trade, which is why a strategy based on services exports worked well and why deglobalisation will be particularly painful. Turning today's rhetoric into policy will be hard because it presents acute trade-offs. Green schemes that prioritise British manufacturers over cheap foreign rivals are liable to raise costs for taxpayers and consumers. It is naive to think that what is the cheapest is always the best, says Ms. Reeves. But such considerations will weigh heavily on a Treasury that is short of money. Labour's account is also a strikingly pessimistic view of globalisation. Markets responded far more dynamically than Britain's hapless politicians to the COVID-19 pandemic and to the energy shock caused by the war in Ukraine. The notion that the cruel winds of globalisation are the cause of Britain's current economic malaise is muddled. Britons are moving between jobs, industries and regions less than they used to. Stagnation is a much bigger problem than disruption. Ironically, a party which is turning the page on Sir Tony's ideas relies on an electorate that increasingly reflects the world he foresaw in 1996. Services account for an even bigger share of the British economy than in 1997. Around two-fifths of Labour's prospective voters went to university. They are more diverse and have a much keener sense of Britain's place in the world. The hijinks in Tokyo have aged poorly. The recipe for how a smallish island contends with a more competitive world remains sound.